we are back with episode 837 of The Critical Myth. I'm Jeff Preston. Tonight we have...
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and we get to talk about shows with spaceships. Woohoo!
Yes, that's right. At least one or two now. We'll see if we get through all the shows in this show or if we break it up. But at any rate, we are getting into the episodic discussion, which means that, Gary, you need to give a disclaimer.
Yes. As we're discussing these episodes, we've tried to give you a week or in some cases, several weeks to catch up on these shows. We will be talking about secrets, revealing plot lines and other minutiae, which you might feel constitute as spoilers. But we're just doing it because we think these shows are awesome, cool, and we want to talk about all the great stuff that happens. So once again, we will be spoiling some of these shows, but it's meant just to further our discussions and not meant to backstab anyone in any way.
No, we let the backstabbing happen on the shows, and then we talk about it. Wahaha. All right, well, as we've basically been doing the last few shows, or a few weeks, or whatever you want to call it, we're just jumping into basically however many weeks we have. We're not doing this episode by episode, per se, but we're talking about show by show. And the way that it's always been in the past is that, essentially, our week starts on Wednesdays. And then ends on Tuesdays. So we're going to talk about the shows that air on Wednesday nights, which I think actually I'm the only one who actually watches any right now, so I'll go through these quickly. What I can say is that there were a couple episodes of Riverdale. There was season 2, episode 3, The Watcher in the Woods, and then episode 4, The Town That Dreaded Sundown. And I gotta say, I think that the second season of Riverdale is better than the first at this point. It's darker, it's a little campier even. They are kind of amping up all the things that worked last season and making them even more so. And I'm just enjoying the heck out of it. It's averaging an 8 for me, and for good reason.
Fine, John. I will binge it over the next 2 days. Okay, fine.
There you go. Me. Okay, exactly. I told you it's a good time to catch up in December, right?
Yeah.
Everybody is on their game, and even Archie seems to be a better character this time than he was a little bit dense.
A little?
Yeah. Okay. He was favorably compared to neutron stars in terms of density. So we'll just leave it at that. Also, we have, and it's always difficult to talk about this particular show's titles, but Mr. Robot, Season 3, Episodes 3 and 4. So Legacy, basically, and Metadata Part 2, one could say. These were some really good episodes. I think that the third season is a return to form. I didn't have nearly as much of a problem as many people did with the second season, although certainly it had its storytelling conceits. I think that this season it is back on its top of its game. If anything, each episode seems to be a little bit better, so it's averaging 8 or higher this season, and I'm really enjoying it. We're getting deeper into the conflict, the internal conflict, we should say, between Elliot and Mr. Robot, and yeah, it's just a lot of fun watching this show. It is definitely not something you watch casually. You know, with the seasons being relatively short, it's a good watch. Definitely interesting timing. Oh, we're going to watch this around the Thanksgiving holidays and go mad. yes, but definitely a great show. I'm very happy that it's on the air right now. Turning to Thursdays, I'm also relatively pleased with the progress on Supernatural. We have season 13. My God. Episode 3, Patience, and then episode 4, The Big Empty. Now, I know that, Gary, you have some family members that watch this show.
Yes.
I don't know if they're caught up now and watching new episodes, but...
No, they started at the beginning. I believe we've made it up to season 9.
All right. So
we'll probably be done in the next few months, but it's definitely interesting.
Well, carry on those wayward sons. We have, one of the interesting things is that third episode, Patience, was essentially a backdoor pilot for the much-discussed potential spinoff, Wayward Daughters, I believe it is called now, which is a kind of a female-fronted version of, or a spinoff of Supernatural. And if it's anything like this episode, it's going to do just fine. This one I really enjoyed. They did a much better job of setting this episode up as both an episode of Supernatural and a backdoor pilot than they did when they tried this a few seasons ago. And I really liked it. I hope that it's a successful spinoff. The Big Empty was a pretty interesting episode, too. And, right now, even though it did have a little bit of a stumble in my mind early on, I feel like this season is doing a really nice job of keeping the storytelling going. It can't be easy. I mean, 13 seasons. Can you imagine, for instance, Gary, if The Next Generation had 13 seasons.
We would get that Spot episode that we've been dying for?
Yes. An episode from the perspective of Spot. As he is fed.
Yes.
By Worf. Boy, everyone remembers that joke. It's great. But yeah, I'm really enjoying it. Let's move to a show that I know that we both watch, Arrow. We had two episodes here. We had Season 6, Episode 3, Next of Kin. And then we had Episode 4, Reversal. So let's see. Next of Kin was where, yes, they break into, what does it say here? A rogue Black Ops team led by Onyx breaks into Cord Industries and steals something lethal. And Reversal is, just as Oliver starts to get things back in order, Black Siren launches another attack on the citizens of Star City. And this is where we see, for the first time, this season's big bad. And it turns out that it's either, depending on how you want to look at it, Ben Linus from Lost.
Yes, yeah.
Or Finch from Person of Interest.
Much better, yeah,
Person of Interest, yeah. Oh, kind of feels like a mixture of the two, to be perfectly honest with you. Because both were pretty solid characters. But imagine if Finch on Person of Interest went bad. And kind of diabolical. The way that Ben Linus was. Now you have the character on Arrow, and I think he did a really bang-up job. You seem to have enjoyed these two episodes as well. I think we both gave it above-average scores for both.
Oh, yeah. I'm enjoying the post-Oliver Queen Arrowverse. I felt it was sort of stuck in old material, no matter how much they tried to get out of it. I'm enjoying the lack of flashbacks. I'm enjoying Alicity again. There's lots of enjoying. The only
The Alicity thing was a little bit of a surprise to me, to be honest with you, because I really thought they had put that to bed, and then out of nowhere, it seems like now it's Now it seems like they really brought it back, and instead of it feeling like a retread, they are actually playing it out as two people who have been there, broken up, and now they've grown to enough of an extent that they can try again. With a little bit more maturity on both their parts. And yes. I thought that that was a neat trick to pull because Oliver is not exactly the most, shall we say, teachable individual.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So I like that a lot. I love how, even though Diggle has always been a competent person, he's now that he's the sole leader, he's having to grow a little bit and as well as, face his own demons and difficulties. So we're still getting that tortured Arrow, regardless of who's actually in the green hood, which is good. I think it works for the format of the show, and it's endemic to the nature of the show that Green Arrow be troubled in some way. Mm-hmm. The only thing I'm sort of wishing that they would resolve somehow is the Lance family drama. Why, when this replacement Laurel shows up all the time, that Detective Lance has to spiral down into this dark, deep place for, geez, what I think is the third time now as I'm watching this show. It was okay when it first.
His contract.
Geez, it feels that way. And the actors can do so much more than be trapped, pigeonholed into this this guilt spiral that they write the character into. I'm not saying he can't still be shaken or upset when he sees her, but this is about the third or fourth time that he's seen this woman. I would think that at some point he would start dealing with it more than just this total collapse that seems to overtake him. So I hope they grow his character a little bit. But other than that, I do enjoy seeing Black Siren. I think she's a nice villain to have to sort of offset the goody goodies per se, but at the same time have that back link to the to earlier times of the season that makes you remember when Laurel was good and part of the team, even though this isn't her and she's not. It still gives you that sort of sense or that longing for it that I find enjoyable. So I think they're going in a good direction. I hope they keep going. I like this. Oliver being having to stay at the table when Felicity takes off. It's quite a humorous change in positions. And while I don't know that they could pull it off forever, at least for short term, I'm really enjoying it. So I'd like them to keep Oliver out for a little while longer. I'm enjoying, as I said, I'm enjoying the non-Queen Arrow teams.
Yeah, definitely. I love the fact that they got to switch things up. I mean, it wasn't exactly what they meant by reversal, but it certainly worked. Having Oliver be Overwatch and Felicity in the field was just this season is giving us a different look at Oliver And I think that that's the important part. We're not just getting the same thing over and over again. We are getting something new. And like you said, Diggle being the arrow for right now is forcing the team to adjust to his style. And we're seeing an evolution of everyone's character. And, you know, that was a big complaint that we've had over the years is that, you know, what exactly is going on here? You know, are we just going to keep getting retreads? And we're definitely not getting that right now. So I'm pretty happy with Arrow. And, of course, the next show on the list would be The Orville. So we have two episodes here. We have Season 1, Episode 7, Majority Rule. And we have Season 1, Episode 8, Into the Fold. And, man, it seems like, Gary, you really enjoyed these episodes. Or at least you certainly did on Into the Fold, which is...
Yeah, I enjoyed that a lot. I was a little critical of the majority rule. While I've been saying that I'm enjoying the moral story or background to the stories that Orville is throwing out there, and I know I commented on one of our previous shows how, you know, I thought that's sort of Star Trek's function. Although sometimes I guess they go a little too far. It just felt like they were slapping us in the face with this one a little harder than usual. Next Generation, which I think everybody agrees this is modeled after, had some heavy-handed moment episodes as well. So I'm definitely not saying that this is how could Orville do something like this, because the source data did the same thing with several episodes. But it just came across a little heavy as a social commentary, maybe stronger than it needed to, in the sense that it almost made it comical versus being insightful, I guess is what I'm trying to say, if that makes sense. They took it to the extreme where it almost seemed laughable versus disturbing. And I would have liked it to stay a little bit more on the disturbing side than the laughing side.
I think, you know, I'll disagree this much. I think that they balanced it out pretty well, in my opinion. I think that also there was a... this hewed less Trek, or at least it merged Trek with, an episode of Doctor Who, where they had a similar thing where there was a version of Big Brother where they actually, when the person was evicted from the apartment, they were killed, if you remember that one from several years ago. And it felt like they took the first season episode from Next Generation Justice, mixed it with that episode of Doctor Who, and sprinkled in some McFarlane humor into it. But what I was really impressed by is the fact that they really just went right after today's social media culture. And it was during a time when there is actually a lot, as we know right now, sometimes justified, but it does feel like there is a lot of, basically mob justice taking place on social media these days, where, you know, there's an accusation and before even the merits of any type of quote unquote case can be discussed, the mob goes after. And like I said, in many cases, it may be justified. In other cases, it's just it now people are in this mode where it seems like they're out to see, like, oh, who can we get next? And you can imagine that then becoming a matter of, well, that neighbor of mine is a real jerk. Let's get him. And this episode really went right there. And it was saying basically, like, because here's where it's obviously going after Facebook, Reddit, Twitter, and all this kind of stuff. What really got to me was even today, I was listening to a podcast, and there was there's some controversy around the new Star Wars game. And the in-game transactions that are available, and some of the comments that came out about it. And one of the comments in the article about the controversy was that the EA publicity team tweet that was republished on Reddit was the most downvoted comment in the history of Reddit or something like that. And I said, that's exactly what they were doing on that show. So I really felt like it was actually, it had its finger on the pulse of internet culture, and in a scathing way that I think is absolutely justified. And yeah, I thought that it was actually it was not unlike the episode earlier this season that was going after gender identity issues to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. But I think it did it better. And they're still trying to find the perfect balance. And maybe that's what you're feeling. But to me, the fact that they're even trying is something that a lot of shows these days don't bother doing.
Yes.
And so I'm happy to give them a bit of leeway when they're at least making the effort to challenge what some people would say is safe storytelling. Because they are doing exactly what the classic Star Trek, in my opinion, always does. And that is, you know, use the medium as a means of exploring social commentary. And sometimes it does it elegantly, and sometimes it doesn't, but at least they're making an attempt at it, in my opinion.
Hmm.
And then, of course, the second episode was a surprisingly strong, straight-up adventure, really, with some, you know, some comedic notes, but wow, I mean, I was not expecting them to pull what really felt like a something that you would have seen out of maybe Deep Space Nine with, you know, Jake and Nog having to, survive on a planet with Odo or something, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's like Cassidy Yates, you know, crashed on her planet with a, yeah.
Absolutely. It felt so authentic, which was like, you know, coming right on the heels of the other one. They're really taking a lot of, ground on here in this first season of the show. So it's very clear that they're fans of Trek and classic sci-fi. And in fact, what I actually am very happy to report is that there are a lot of people who feel like it's almost too much a love letter to Trek, which is tells me that they're actually doing it right.
Well, you know, for years, people have been dying for Star Trek to come back. And while I'm not going to bring up Discovery too much, except to say about Orville, that Orville is Star Trek back. It's a little different in format, just as I would argue that, you know, Deep Space Nine was different in format from Next Generation, was different in format from Enterprise. But it still, you know, as you said, hits home with these messages and, you know, does it honestly and well. So I'm fine with it. It's a little bit more slapstick, admittedly, but they've toned that down to a great deal. So I'm thrilled with that. And, you know, this, you know, somebody in jeopardy from a shuttle crashing is, you know, is a classic script move that some people argue is, you know, a rehashing of many Star Trek plots. But, you know, a ship in danger is a classic science fiction genre problem anyway. So, you know, that your ship crashed on a strange planet is about as Pulp Fiction as you can get. Getting caught with a disease as a result of it as well is still standard fare that I don't think is limited to Trek. So, you know, as you said, they're lovers not only of Trek, but of classic sci-fi. So good job, guys. Good job.
Absolutely. All right, we can move on then to the next showdown. Now we're talking about Friday Nights, and I believe that once again, this is one where it's more what I'm watching, but let's at least start with The Exorcist. Season 2, Episode 5 had an episode there, but for the grace of God, go I. And let me say, this season is really bringing it, and this episode in particular was super creepy. I have to give it to the producers. I was describing this, and definitely spoilers here, everyone. If you haven't been watching this, sorry, I do have to talk about this, though. There, basically, the guy who plays Sulu in the Kelvin timeline...
show.
Yes. He basically is playing a guy who runs an orphanage, if you will, or a foster home for kids who are having trouble getting adopted. And it's kind of in a remote area around Seattle, maybe, you know, near, you know, kind of further out from there, but in Washington State, I believe. And the thing is that it's remote. So, of course, all you get are the, you know, him and the kids and the people who visit. And so you take it on faith that as he's interacting with the kids, that that's normal. And in this episode, what they kind of revealed, if I understood it correctly, is that one of the kids that he's been interacting with all this time is not really there. And you really start thinking back and going, wait, I've never actually remembered the other kids interacting with that one. It's only been him. And it very obviously becomes, it starts to spool out that this has been the demonic entity the entire time. Weaving its web around the main character. And it's done in such a way that is so creepy because this kid has always been portrayed as this, you know, oh, she doesn't like to go outside. She likes to stay in. She likes to hang out with the dude and you know, like, spend time with him. But, you know, you have to stay inside or stay with me or be close to the house. And she, when she is around everyone else, she would wear, like, a hood over her head with, you know, cut-out eyes. and you just thought that it was the quirk of this kid, but really it becomes so much creepier when you realize this is actually a demonic entity. And it's just really well done. This is, of course, it's accentuated by the fact that usually these shows don't scare me very much. They're at most unnerving, so I try to amp it up as much as possible by watching it like in the dark on my tablet with headphones on, because then the sound design is it really jumps out, and it really works well. I think that I was shocked that this show came back for a second season, but I'm really glad that it did, because the storytelling is really quite good, especially when you consider that this is horror on a major network. It's amazing to think that Fox is putting this out, because it can get very, very disturbing sometimes, which is pretty cool. The other show on Friday nights that has been on is The Inhumans. And I want to say that it's the show that is coming in at the bottom of the list repeatedly, but that's not actually true. but it's close. And for a lot of the same reasons, there were two episodes, episode 6, The Gentleman's Name is Gorgon, and episode 7, Havoc in the Hidden Land. It's average right now. It did improve over its beginning, but only in a very mediocre way. This is clearly not as good as the DCW shows for the most part, and it's definitely not at all on the same scale as Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or the Marvel Netflix shows. The one that it most resembles is Iron Fist, which makes sense because the same guy who made Iron Fist made Inhumans. And we've mentioned that before. And it's the same problem that Iron Fist had. Iron Fist tried to play up its style as a send-up of 80s ninja movies. We mentioned this before. And when it tried to do that, it went up against the fact that it was in the same universe as the other Marvel Netflix shows. And so much so that when Danny Rand went into the Defenders, he was the butt of everyone's joke. The Inhumans is not much better, mainly because it tells an incredibly obvious story. But everything from the set design to the costume design to the way that it's filmed is clearly meant to be to evoke the memories of pulpy comic book stories of years past, but it's just played too straight. Sorry about that. Clearly the dogs agree. Lockjaw must have come to say hello. But yes, it's missed opportunity. Just like Iron Fist, you tweak it just a little bit, and I think it would play so much better. But everyone is playing this as though it's going to be presented as this very played-up comic book-type story, and instead it is introduced almost like it should be taken fully seriously. And I think that that's its biggest problem, is that it also doesn't tell a story that's that surprising. You can pretty much predict what's going to happen throughout this story the entire way through. But anyway, moving on then to something that's a little bit better. On Sunday nights, I'll just say that the first portion of the run, I'm hoping that they run the rest of the episodes of this. I'm hoping it wasn't like poorly rated. Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams was spooling out on BBC, I believe it was, over in the UK. Had an episode called Human Is that was actually really quite interesting. It reminded me of a classic Twilight Zone tale or Outer Limits. I thought it was pretty good, and I was kind of sad that that was the last one that they ran, and they haven't run any since then. So I'm keeping my eyes and ears out to see when the next one will come on. But let's see. I'm just going to check time real quick. Yeah, we can keep going. The next one on the list, of course, for our list would be Star Trek Discovery. And we had two episodes here. We had episode 7, Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad, a very big Harry Mudd episode. And then we had, it's Latin. And I took 3 years of Latin. You'd think that I'd know how to say this, but it was a while ago. So
it was great to me.
Civis Pacem Parabellum. So, yes, it was the first half of the mid-season finale, which is a really weird statement to say, actually, now that I think about it. But, yes, episodes 7 and 8. Now, Gary, I am curious, because we talked about Harry Mudd before.
Yes, we did.
And it seems like we both liked these episodes pretty well. So this was even more of a departure from Mudd's background, from what I could tell. But you really liked the episode, so talk about it. What did you think? Did you like about it?
Well, you say it was a departure, yet I felt that this was honing in a little truer to the character that in some ways the bloodthirstiness of him, I still don't care for that portrayal. He always seemed like an opportunist that if somebody got hurt along the way, so be it, but he wouldn't be the one to actually pull the trigger on them. directly, which is exactly what he did actually in one or two of the time loop incarnations that this show had, where he killed Lorca at least once directly by shooting him in the, you know, shooting him in the face. So that was a little sad that they decided they needed to make him that edgy. If I try to overlook that, which I did, I can see where he, you know, the general humor of the episode, I think, was stronger than the violence that they needlessly, in my opinion, introduced. The ability to reset, I would think, would preclude a lot of that. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed the time loop discovery, so to speak, by was it Stannis?
Stamets.
Stamets, being connected to the mycelium network. Actually, that made a little bit of sense, and it was easy for me to suspend my disbelief and, you know, go forward with that concept. And I loved how, you know, he knew everything had happened, or at least several times at some point had figured it out. I forget how many times Harry Mudd said he actually went through this whole loop, but I thought it was on the order of hundreds of times by the time that Harry had mentioned, at least.
Oh yeah.
I'm not sure when Stamets actually figured it out, but even he was getting fed up with it as well. So that I enjoyed that it was Stamets and not Michael that figured it out, and I'm glad she didn't become the so to speak, you know, somehow she figured it out on her own, but it made much more sense for Stamets. So I like that part of it. I also enjoyed that we finally got to meet Stella. For decades, we have, other than a robot version, we've never got to see the real Stella. So that was a nice little nod, not only to continuity, but, you know, like I said, I think that was them trying to do good by old-time fans with not just using Harry Mudd, but also, you know, throwing in little details like that, as well as finally giving us much more of Mudd's backstory, which we really had no sense of. So I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that aspect a lot.
I feel like going to Stella and other things like that, I feel like, yes, it name-checked certain things, but at the same time, it also didn't feel like it quite lined up with what we knew from the original series. And while I know that there are slight variations that we've been playing with or that we've got to get used to and so on and so forth, it just felt like, it's still not quite hitting it the way that I'm expecting it to. I am kind of still on the fence that wouldn't it have made sense more for them to have said that this was that this took place in the Kelvin timeline, because it still feels like I could have easily accepted this as the Kelvin version of what happened. But
poking a sore spot, John.
I may be poking a sore spot, but come on. You know that they're changing a lot of things. So
anyway. I really can't be going to more detail than that, John. Suffice to say, I understand what you're saying, and I can't completely disagree. This does feel slightly off. But I do need somebody to answer me one thing. The Spore Drive is supposed to be some ultra-secret Starfleet weapon. And now Mudd knows all about it, and they're going to let him get onto that spacecraft with Stella and fly off into the great wide galaxy? I don't get it. Come on,
see,
Lorca.
That's why
come
it
on,
makes sense for it to Lorca, be the Kelvin Lorca, timeline.
Lorca, why aren't you like locking them away somewhere we don't, you know, next to that Gorn skeleton? Well, I just don't get it.
I will say this though, these episodes, because I mean, we can talk about the next one, but it is the first half of a two-parter for all intent and purposes. Certainly, both of them feel more like classic Trek in their origins, or at least in their intent. I feel like these are stories that fit very nicely on as riffs on original series stories. Like, a time loop like this is such a classic science fiction thing at this point that it's almost hard to come up with something that is original. And yet I think they did a nice job, even if there are certain aspects that felt a little overdone at this point. I think that it worked. I think that they did a very good job with it. And certainly the next one, where they wound up dealing with this non-corporeal entity on the planet that, you know, basically was willing to do some pretty crazy things to try and stop the war, which actually made things worse. I think that they delved into character far more than they have up to this point, and I've really liked it. I think that it's getting closer and closer to the show that we were hoping Discovery would be.
Yes, but is that the show that Brian Fuller put forth?
I'm willing to think that it is.
I wonder if they're – well, I won't argue with you so much as just agree to disagree. My question is, as we see this thing – what's the word I'm looking for? Drift back into more Trek-like constructs and, you know, thoughts and messages, just which is what we wanted per se. It feels awfully different than what we saw in the beginning of the season.
Maybe, but from what I understood, they were still following his general idea.
Okay.
And the reason that I think that it's still in the DNA is, again, Mudd's bloodthirstiness. He feels more like a modern villain than he does the kind of con man that was in the 60s. This feels like a modern con man type of thing. Hmm. More to the point, Lorca. Lorca as maybe not the main character, but as the captain, it almost feels like something that Fuller would do, which is kind of like, what would it be like to be on the crew of Captain Garth? Or one of these other captains that went rogue? Because right now he is useful and tolerated by Starfleet Command because he is promising and even delivering a solution to the Klingon War. But he is clearly skirting the anti-eugenics laws. He is skirting all kinds of things, including in Episode 8, The Prime Directive. He is employing people on his crew that should never be on the bridge of a starship again. And they're constantly engaging in all these off-book, really questionable decisions. And he's, I felt like, you know, he, at one point in an earlier episode, he was contemplating that if he was going to be turned in by the Admiral, that he might have killed her. And,
well,
you know, we never
I think
know.
You're interpreting.
Well, it's a question, though.
Well, you know, it feels like they in some senses are drawing on a lot of Trek, especially, you know, some of the characters and even some of these plot lines remind me a lot of the New Frontier series with Captain Calhoun.
Absolutely.
Lorca seems maybe not exactly, and I don't mean to detract from any Calhoun supporters, but I feel he's got that edge and that sense about him that definitely echoes Calhoun for me. Perhaps he bends the rules even more so. But
it feels like a kind of a darker version of Calhoun.
Yeah.
Like Calhoun would be more irreverent. Lorca is more, I don't want to say malevolent, but he is definitely, he has an agenda
yes.
that he wants to pursue. And what I feel like this story is, quite frankly, and, you know, maybe we'll see this play out throughout the rest of the season, but these episodes, these recent ones, really made me think this is building up to the consequences of what happens when Starfleet lets one of these captains run rampant. And maybe that's why in Kirk's time, they are a lot more likely to clamp down on it. And scrub all records of what he did because they disavow him and what his ship did. And I can see that being a Fuller-esque type of story where it's like, what is a Starfleet willing to accept in the name of protecting
victory.
And yeah. for a victory and protecting itself and it and its own. And that I think is a very interesting story. And it actually gives the name Discovery a lot of interesting, innuendo to a degree, because it's not just a discovery of new horizons and new frontiers, it's a discovery of what the heart of the Federation is all about.
Mm.
And I think that is very close to what he was trying to do. I think he would have pushed it further. I think it would have been even darker and perhaps more even more edgy, if you will. But I think that the core of what he was trying to do is still built into the DNA of it.
Okay.
And it's my opinion because, I mean, everybody, Fuller has so many different looks. I mean, we're thinking right now about maybe Hannibal, but I mean, wasn't Fuller also involved in things like Pushing Daisies? So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, Wonderfalls, you know, he takes things and he tweaks them and shows a different side of them. And I think that that's what he's trying to do. But it's also very clear that, you know, he had already brought on when he was still there, he brought on Trek authors because I think Kristen Meyer, or Kirsten Meyer, I forget exactly how she says her first name, but she wrote the episode, episode 8, that felt like such a classic Star Trek thing. You know, they're on the planet, there's this life form, and it's, you know, how far is it willing to go in order to impose peace, and all of this kind of stuff. And it reminded me of, you know, a more, insidious version of the Organians, or something like that. So it was, you know, definitely something that you could see a classic Trek author adding to it. I feel like it definitely has those overtones of Nicholas Meyer in the show, the military versus science tension that I'm sure that that's what Fuller brought him, you know, brought him on to include. But I feel like as much as we felt like the earlier episodes were departing maybe too much from the mold, I think mm-hmm. that now they are finding their voice and they're delving more and more into the characters. And I think even a really smart side of this is that while they still have Burnham involved, of course, as the main quote-unquote main character, they are giving a lot of other characters voices now, too.
I was going to say, does she feel like the main character to you at this point? Because I'm questioning it.
I feel like it's an ensemble.
Yeah.
I think she's still meant to be our viewpoint character, but I really like seeing things from other points of view as well. I'm really curious as to where some of these characters are going to go, because I also feel like they're getting us to know and like these characters more, so that when bad things start to happen, it hurts a lot more. Because I feel like this is a cautionary tale. It feels like that's where they're going with this. And I really hope they do, because I think that that's going to be a much more interesting story at the end of the day. Anything else to say about Discovery other than the fact that, you know, it seems like we're actually starting to enjoy it more and more?
Let's see. I guess we're kind of holding back a little bit on part two. So for part one, I found it interesting that, you know, given all those jumps, that it took Mudd that long to find out as little as he found out. I would have thought he would have figured it out much earlier, and that sort of makes me question his general competency in general, you know, as to how effective he is. And I guess maybe that's one of the reasons they were able to defeat him with him having such a advantage during the whole thing, that he is somewhat incompetent. So it's easier to take him on. But yeah, I feel like they are drifting towards what I would like this show to be, and I hope it keeps going that way. It's we're in the middle of a war, and there's shortcuts being taken, and things are happening that in a perfect Federation environment it wouldn't. But at the same time, in some ways, it almost feels like the show's getting a hair lighter, and I personally like that. So I felt it started off extremely dark, and it feels like they've been backing off of that just a little bit. So I'm grateful for that. So that's about it.
Yeah, I think it's finding its voice. I think that's the way I put it before, and I think that's still the way that I would describe it now. All right, let's switch gears a little bit. Looking at the time, and actually, what we're going to do is we are going to stop here, and we'll pick up with the rest of the shows in a third episode. So it'll be a shorter third episode, but it'll still be a third one. So until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time. Watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.